Welcome to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Emily of New Moon. Beloved for her iconic role as Miss Stacy in the classic television series Anne of Green Gables, celebrated Canadian actress Marilyn Lightstone now returns to the world of Lucy Maud Montgomery and the magic of Prince Edward Island to bring to life the unforgettable coming-of-age story of the imaginative young heroine Emily Starr. If this is your first time joining us, you can find all episodes of Marilyn Lightstone Reads at classicalfm.ca or on your favorite podcast app. And now, let's turn to Marilyn as she reads Emily of New Moon.
Chapter 13. A Daughter of Eve. New Moon was noted for its apples, and on that first autumn of Emily's life there, both the old and the new orchards bore a bumper crop. In the new were the titled and pedigreed apples, and in the old the seedlings, unknown to catalogues, that yet had a flavor wildly sweet, all their own. There was no taboo on any apple, and Emily was free to eat all she wanted of each and every kind, the only prohibition being that she must not take any to bed with her. Aunt Elizabeth, very properly, did not want her bed messed up with apple seeds, and Aunt Laura had a horror of anyone eating apples in the dark, lest they might eat an apple worm into the bargain. Emily, therefore, should have been able fully to satisfy her appetite for apples at home. But there is a certain odd kink in human nature by reason of which the flavor of the apples belonging to somebody else is always vastly superior to our own, as the crafty serpent of Eden very well knew. Emily, like most people, possessed this kink, and consequently thought that nowhere were there such delicious apples as those belonging to Lofty John. He was in the habit of keeping a long row of apples on one of the beams in his workshop, and it was understood that she and Ilsa might help themselves freely whenever they visited that charming, dusty, shaving-carpeted spot. Three varieties of Lofty John's apples were their especial favorites. The scabby apples, that looked as if they had leprosy, but were of unsurpassed deliciousness under their queerly blotched skins. The little red apples, scarcely bigger than a crab, deep crimson all over and glossy as satin, that had such a sweet, nutty flavor. And the big green sweet apples that children usually thought the best of all. Emily considered that day wasted, whose low descending sun had not beheld her munching one of Lofty John's big green sweets. In the back of her mind, Emily knew quite well that she should not be going to Lofty John's at all. To be sure, she had never been forbidden to go, simply because it had never occurred to her aunts that an inmate of New Moon could so forget the beloved old family feud between the houses of Murray and Sullivan belonging to two generations back. It was an inheritance that any proper Murray would live up to as a matter of course. But when Emily was off with that wild little Ishmaelite of an Ilsa, traditions lost their power under the allurement of Lofty John's reds and scabs. She wandered rather lonesomely into his workshop one September evening at twilight. She had been alone since she came from school. Her aunts and cousin Jimmy had gone to Shrewsbury, promising to be back by sunset. Ilsa was away also. Her father, prodded thereto by Mrs. Sims, having taken her to Charlottetown to get her a winter coat. Emily liked being alone very well at first. She felt quite important over being in charge of New Moon. She ate the supper Aunt Laura had left on the cookhouse dresser for her, and she went into the dairy and skimmed six lovely big pans of milk. She had no business at all to do this, but she had always hankered to do it, and this was too good a chance to be missed. She did it beautifully, and nobody ever knew, each aunt supposing the other had done it, and so she was never scolded for it. This does not point any particular moral, of course. In a proper yarn, Emily should either have been found out and punished for disobedience, or been driven by an uneasy conscience to confess. But I am sorry. Or, ought to be, to have to state that Emily's conscience never worried her about the matter at all. Still, she was doomed to suffer enough that night from an entirely different cause to balance all her little peccadilloes. By the time the cream was skimmed and poured into the big stone crock and well stirred, Emily didn't forget that either. It was after sunset, and still nobody had come home. Emily didn't like the idea of going alone into the big, dusky, echoing house, so she hied her to Lofty John's shop, which she found unoccupied, though the plane halted midway on a board indicated that Lofty John had been working there quite recently and would probably return. Emily sat down on a round section of a huge log and looked around to see what she could get to eat. There was a row of reds and scabs clean across the side of the shop, but no sweet among them, and Emily felt that what she needed just then was a sweet and nothing else. Then she spied one, a huge one, the biggest sweet Emily had ever seen, all by itself on one of the steps of the stair leading up to the loft. She climbed up, possessed herself of it, and ate it out of hand. She was gnawing happily at the core when Lofty John came in. He nodded to her with a seemingly careless glance around.
"Just been in to get my supper," he said. "The wife's away, so I had to get it myself."
He fell to planing in silence. Emily sat on the stairs, counting the seeds of the big sweet. You told your fortunes by the seeds, listening to the wind woman whistling elfishly through a knothole in the loft and composing a description of Lofty John's carpenter shop by lantern light, to be written later on a letter bill. She was lost in a mental hut for an accurate phrase to picture the absurd, elongated shadow of Lofty John's nose on the opposite wall, when Lofty John whirled about so suddenly that the shadow of his nose shot upward like a huge spear to the ceiling and demanded in a startled voice,
"What's become of that big sweet apple that was on that stair?"
"Why, I ate it," stammered Emily. Lofty John dropped his plane, threw up his hands, and looked at Emily with a horrified face.
"The saints preserve us, child! You never ate that apple! Don't tell me you've gone and ate that apple!"
"Yes, I did," said Emily, uncomfortably. "I didn't think it was any harm. I—"
"Harm? Listen to her, will you? That apple was poison for the rats! They've been plaguing me life out here, and I had me mind made up to finish their fun. And now you've ate the apple? It'd kill a dozen of you in a brace of shakes."
Lofty John saw a white face and a gingham apron flash through the workshop and out into the dark. Emily's first wild impulse was to get home at once before she dropped dead. She tore across the field through the bush and the garden and dashed into the house. It was still silent and dark. Nobody was home yet. Emily gave a bitter little shriek of despair. When they came, they would find her stiff and cold, black in the face likely. Everything in this dear world ended for her forever, all because she had eaten an apple which she thought she was perfectly welcome to eat. It wasn't fair. She didn't want to die. But she must. She only hoped desperately that someone would come before she was dead. It would be so terrible to die there all alone in that great big empty new moon. She dared not try to go anywhere for help. It was too dark now, and she would likely drop dead on the way. To die out there, alone, in the dark. Oh, that would be too dreadful. It had not occurred to her that anything could be done for her. She thought if you once swallowed poison, that was the end of you. With hands shaking in panic, she got a candle lighted. It wasn't quite so bad then. You could face things in the light. And Emily, pale, terrified, alone, was already deciding that this must be faced bravely. She must not shame the stars and the Murrays. She clenched her cold hands and tried to stop trembling. How long would it be before she died, she wondered.
Lofty John had said the apple would kill her in a brace of shakes. What did that mean? How long was a brace of shakes? Would it hurt her to die? She had a vague idea that poison did hurt you awfully. Oh, and just a little while ago she had been so happy. She had thought she was going to live for years and write great poems and be famous like Mrs. Hemans. She had had a fight with Ilse the night before and hadn't made it up yet. Never could make it up now. And Ilse would feel so terribly. She must write her a note and forgive her. Was there time for that much? Oh, how cold her hands were. Perhaps that meant she was dying already. She had heard or read that your hands turn cold when you were dying. She wondered if her face was turning black. She grasped her candle and hurried up the stairs to the spare room. There was a looking-glass there, the only one in the house hung low enough for her to see her reflection if she tipped the bottom of it back. Ordinarily, Emily would have been frightened to death at the mere thought of going into that spare room by dim flickering candlelight. But the one great terror had swallowed up all lesser ones. She looked at her reflection amid the sleek black flow of her hair in the upward striking light on the dark background of the shadowy room. Oh, she was pale as the dead already. Yes, that was a dying face. There could be no doubt of it. Something rose up in Emily and took possession of her. Some inheritance from the good old stock behind her. She ceased to tremble. She accepted her fate with bitter regret, but calmly. I don't want to die, but since I have to, I'll die as becomes a Murray, she said. She had read a similar sentence in a book, and it came pat to the moment. But now she must hurry. That letter to Ilse must be written. Emily went to Aunt Elizabeth's room first to assure herself that her right-hand top bureau drawer was quite tidy. Then she flitted up the garret stairs to her dormer corner. The great place was full of lurking, pouncing shadows that crowded about the little island of faint candlelight. But they had no terrors for Emily now.
To think I was feeling so bad today because my petticoat was bunchy, she thought, as she got one of her dear letter bills, the last she would ever write on. There was no need to write to Father. She would see him soon. But Ilse must have her letter. Dear, loving, jolly, hot-tempered Ilse, who just the day before had shrieked insulting epithets after her, and who would be haunted by remorse all her life for it. Dearest Ilse, wrote Emily, her hand shaking a little but her lips firmly set, I am going to die. I have been poisoned by an apple Lofty John had put for rats. I will never see you again. But I am writing this to tell you I love you, and you are not to feel bad because you called me a skunk and a bloodthirsty mink yesterday. I forgive you, so do not worry over it. And I am sorry I told you that you were beneath contempt, because I didn't mean a word of it. I leave you all my share of the broken dishes in our playhouse, and please tell Teddy goodbye for me. He will never be able to teach me how to put worms on a fish hook now. I promised him I would learn, because I did not want him to think I was a coward. But I am glad I did not, for I know what the worm feels like now. I do not feel sick yet, but I don't know what the symptoms of poisoning are, and Lofty John said there was enough to kill a dozen of me, so I can't have long to live. If Aunt Elizabeth is willing, you can have my necklace of Venetian beads. It is the only valuable possession I have. Don't let anybody do anything to Lofty John, because he did not mean to poison me, and it was all my own fault for being so greedy. Perhaps people will think he did it on purpose because I am a Protestant, but I feel sure he did not, and please tell him not to be haunted by remorse. I think I feel a pain in my stomach now, so I guess that the end draws nigh. Farewell, and remember her who died so young. Your own devoted Emily.
As Emily folded up her letter bill, she heard the sound of wheels in the yard below. A moment later, Elizabeth and Laura Murray were confronted in the kitchen by a tragic-faced little creature, grasping a guttering candle in one hand and a red letter bill in the other.
"Emily, what is the matter?" cried Aunt Laura. "I'm dying," said Emily solemnly. "I ate an apple Lofty John had poisoned for rats. I have only a few minutes to live, Aunt Laura."
Laura Murray dropped down on the black bench with her hand at her heart. Elizabeth turned as pale as Emily herself.
"Emily, is this some play-acting of yours?" she demanded sternly.
"No," cried Emily quite indignantly. "It's the truth. Do you suppose a dying person would be play-acting? And oh, Aunt Elizabeth, please will you give this letter to Ilse, and please forgive me for being naughty, though I wasn't always naughty when you thought I was. And don't let anyone see me after I'm dead if I turn black, especially Rhoda Stewart."
By this time, Aunt Elizabeth was herself again.
"How long ago is it since you ate that apple, Emily?"
"About an hour."
"If you'd eaten a poisoned apple an hour ago, you'd be dead or sick by now."
"Oh," cried Emily, transformed in a second. A wild, sweet hope sprang up in her heart. Was there a chance for her after all?
Then she added despairingly,
"But I felt another pain in my stomach just as I came downstairs."
"Laura," said Aunt Elizabeth, "take this child out to the cookhouse and give her a good dose of mustard and water at once. It'll do no harm, and may do some good, if there's anything in this yarn of hers. I'm going down to the doctor's. He may be back, but I'll see Lofty John on the way." Aunt Elizabeth went out, and Aunt Elizabeth went out very quickly. If it had been anyone else, it might have been said she ran. As for Emily, well, Aunt Laura gave her that emetic in short order, and 2 minutes later, Emily had no doubt at all that she was dying then and there, and the sooner the better. When Aunt Elizabeth returned, Emily was lying on the sofa in the kitchen, as white as the pillow under her head and as limp as a faded lily.
"Wasn't the doctor home?" cried Aunt Laura desperately.
"I don't know. There's no need of the doctor. I didn't think there was from the first. It was just one of Lofty John's jokes. He thought he'd give Emily a fright, just for fun. His idea of fun. March you off to bed, Miss Emily. You deserve all you've got for going over there to Lofty John's at all. And I don't pity you a particle. I haven't had such a turn for years."
"I did have a pain in my stomach,"
wailed Emily, in whom fright and mustard and water combined had temporarily extinguished all spirit.
"Anyone who eats apples from dawn to dark must expect a few pains in her stomach. You won't have any more tonight, I reckon. And mustard will remedy that. Take your candle and go."
"Well," said Emily, getting unsteadily to her feet, "I hate that dog-gasted Lofty John."
"Emily!"
said both aunts together.
"He deserves it,"
said Emily vindictively.
"Oh, Emily, that dreadful word you used."
Aunt Laura seemed curiously upset about something.
"Why, what's the matter with dog-gasted?"
said Emily, quite mystified.
"Cousin Jimmy uses it often when things vex him. He used it today. He said that dog-gasted heifer had broken out of the graveyard pasture again."
"Emily,"
said Aunt Elizabeth, with the air of one impaling herself on the easiest horn of a dilemma. "Your cousin Jimmy is a man, and men sometimes use expressions in the heat of anger that are not proper for little girls."
"But what is the matter with dog-gasted?"
persisted Emily.
"It isn't a swear word, is it? And if it isn't, why can't I use it?"
It isn't a ladylike word," said Aunt Laura.
"Well, then, I won't use it any more," said Emily resignedly. "But Lofty John is dog-gasted."
Aunt Laura laughed so much after Emily had gone upstairs that Aunt Elizabeth told her a woman of her age should have more sense.
"Elizabeth, you know it was funny," protested Laura.
Emily, being safely out of sight, Elizabeth permitted herself a somewhat grim smile.
"I told Lofty John a few plain truths. He'll not go telling children they're poisoned again in a hurry. I left him fairly dancing with rage.
Worn out, Emily fell asleep as soon as she was in bed. But an hour later she awakened. Aunt Elizabeth had not yet come to bed, so the blind was still up, and Emily saw a dear, friendly star winking down at her. Far away, the sea moaned alluringly. Oh, it was nice just to be alone and to be alive. Life tasted good to her again. Tasted like more, as Cousin Jimmy said. She could have a chance to write more letter bills and poetry. Emily already saw a yard of verses entitled Thoughts of One Doomed to Sudden Death, and play with Ilsa and Teddy, scour the barns with Saucy Sal, watch Aunt Laura skim cream in the dairy and help Cousin Jimmy garden, read books in Emily's bower, and trot along the Today Road, but not visit Lofty John's workshop. She determined that she would never have anything to do with Lofty John again after his diabolical cruelty. She felt so indignant with him for frightening her, after they had been such good friends, too, that she could not go to sleep until she had composed an account of her death by poison, of Lofty John being tried for her murder and condemned to death, and of his being present at the dreadful scene, in spite of the fact that she was dead by his act. When she had finally cut him down and buried him with obloquy, the tears streaming down her face out of sympathy for Mrs. Lofty John, she forgave him. Very likely he was not Dodgasted after all. She wrote it all down on a letter bill in the garret the next day. Chapter 14. Fancy Fed. In October, Cousin Jimmy began to boil the pig's potatoes. Unromantic name for a most romantic occupation. Or so it appeared to Emily, whose love of the beautiful and picturesque was satisfied as it had never yet been on those long, cool, starry twilights of the waning year at New Moon. There was a clump of spruce trees in a corner of the old orchard, and under them an immense iron pot was hung over a circle of large stones, a pot so big that an ox could have been comfortably stewed in it. Emily thought it must have come down from the days of fairy tales and been some giant's porridge pot, but Cousin Jimmy told her that it was only 100 years old, and old Hugh Murray had had it sent out from England. "We've used it ever since to boil the potatoes for the New Moon pigs," he said. "Blair Water folks think it old-fashioned. They've all got boiler houses now with built-in boilers. But as long as Elizabeth's boss at New Moon, we'll use this." Emily was sure no built-in boiler could have the charm of the big pot. She helped Cousin Jimmy fill it full of potatoes after she came from school. Then, when supper was over, Cousin Jimmy lighted the fire under it and puttered about it all the evening. Sometimes he poked the fire. Emily loved that part of the performance, sending glorious streams of rosy sparks upward into the darkness. Sometimes he stirred the potatoes with a long pole, looking, with his queer, forked gray beard and belted jumper, just like some old gnome or troll of Northland story mixing the contents of a magical cauldron. And sometimes he sat beside Emily on the gray granite boulder near the pot and recited his poetry for her. Emily liked this best of all, for Cousin Jimmy's poetry was surprisingly good, at least in spots, and Cousin Jimmy had fit audience, though few, in this slender little maiden, with her pale, eager face and rapt eyes. They were an odd couple, and they were perfectly happy together. Blair Water people thought Cousin Jimmy a failure and a mental weakling, but he dwelt in an ideal world of which none of them knew anything. He had recited his poems 100 times thus, as he boiled the pig's potatoes. The ghosts of a score of autumns haunted the clump of spruces for him. He was an odd, ridiculous figure enough, bent and wrinkled and unkempt, gesticulating awkwardly as he recited. But it was his hour. He was no longer simple Jimmy Murray, but a prince in his own realm. For a little while, he was strong and young and splendid and beautiful, accredited master of song to a listening, enraptured world. None of his prosperous, sensible Blairwater neighbors ever lived through such an hour. He would not have exchanged places with one of them. Emily, listening to him, felt vaguely that if it had not been for the unlucky push into the New Moon Well, this queer little man besides her might have stood in the presence of kings. But Elizabeth had pushed him into the New Moon Well, and as a consequence he boiled pig's potatoes and recited to Emily. Emily, who wrote poetry too, and loved these evenings so much that she could not sleep after she went to bed until she had composed a minute description of them. The flash came almost every evening over something or other. The Wind Woman swooped or purred in the tossing boughs above them. Emily had never been so near to seeing her. The sharp air was full of a pleasant tang of the burning spruce cones Cousin Jimmy shoveled under the pot. Emily's furry kitten, Mike the Second, frisked and scampered about like a small, charming demon of the night. The fire glowed with beautiful redness and allure through the gloom. There were nice, whispery sounds everywhere. The great, big dark lay spread around them, full of mysteries that daylight never revealed. And over all, a purple sky, powdered with stars. Ilsa and Teddy came too on some evenings. Emily always knew when Teddy was coming, for when he reached the old orchard, he whistled his call, the one he used just for her. A funny, dear little call, like three clear bird notes. The first just medium pitch, the second higher, the third dropping away into lowness and sweetness, long drawn out, like the echoes in the bugle song that went clearer and further in their dying. That call always had an odd effect on Emily. It seemed to her that it fairly drew the heart out of her body, and she had to follow it. She thought Teddy could have whistled her clear across the world with those three magic notes. Whenever she heard it, she ran quickly through the orchard and told Teddy whether Cousin Jimmy wanted him or not, because it was only on certain nights that Cousin Jimmy wanted anybody but her. He would never recite his poetry to Ilsa or Teddy, but he told them fairy stories and tales about the old dead and gone Murrays in the pond graveyard that were as queer sometimes as the fairy stories, and Ilsa would recite too, doing better there than she ever did anywhere else. And sometimes Teddy lay sprawled out on the ground besides the big pot and drew pictures by the light of the fire. Pictures of Cousin Jimmy stirring the potatoes. Pictures of Ilsa and Emily dancing hand in hand around it like two small witches. Pictures of Mike's cunning little whiskered face peering around the old boulder. Pictures of weird, vague faces crowding in the darkness outside their enchanted circle. They had very wonderful evenings there, those four children. "Oh, don't you like the world at night, Ilsa?" Emily once said rapturously. Ilsa glanced happily around her. Poor little neglected Ilsa, who found in Emily's companionship what she had hungered for all her short life, and who was, even now, being led by love into something of her rightful heritage. "Yes," she said, "and I always believe there is a God when I'm here like this." Then the potatoes were done, and Cousin Jimmy gave each of them one before he mixed in the bran. They broke them in pieces on plates of birch bark, sprinkled them with salt, which Emily had cached in a small box under the roots of the biggest spruce, and ate them with gusto. No banquet of gods was ever as delicious as those potatoes. Then finally came Aunt Laura's kind, silvery voice calling through the frosty dark. Ilsa and Teddy scampered homewards, and Emily captured Mike the Second and shut him up safely for the night in the New Moon doghouse, which had held no dog for years, but was still carefully preserved and whitewashed every spring. Emily's heart would have broken if anything had happened to Mike the Second. Old Kelly, the tin peddler, had given him to her. Old Kelly had come round through Blairwater every fortnight from May to November for 30 years, perched on the seat of a bright red peddler's wagon, and behind a dusting, ambling red pony of that peculiar gait and appearance pertaining to the ponies of country peddlers. A certain placid, unhasting leanness, as of a nag that has encountered troubles of his own and has lived them down by sheer patience and staying power. From the bright red wagon proceeded a certain metallic rumbling and clinking as it bowled along, and two huge nests of tin pans on its flat, rope-encircled roof flashed back the sunlight so dazzlingly that old Kelly seemed the beaming sun of a little planetary system all his own. A new broom, sticking up aggressively at each of the four corners, gave the wagon a resemblance to a triumphal chariot. Emily hankered secretly for a ride in old Kelly's wagon. She thought it must be very delightful. Old Kelly and she were great friends. She liked his red, clean-shaven face under his plug hat, his nice, twinkly blue eyes, his brush of upstanding, sandy hair, and his comical, pursed-up mouth, the shape of which was partly due to nature and partly to much whistling. He always had a little three-cornered paper bag of lemon drops for her, or a candy stick of many colors, which he smuggled into her pocket when Aunt Elizabeth wasn't looking. And he never forgot to tell her that he supposed she'd soon be thinking of getting married, for old Kelly thought that the surest way to please a female creature of any age was to tease her about getting married. One day, instead of candy, he produced a plump gray kitten from the back drawer of his wagon and told her it was for her. Emily received the gift rapturously, but after old Kelly had rattled and clattered away, Aunt Elizabeth told her they did not want any more cats at New Moon. "Oh, please let me keep it, Aunt Elizabeth," Emily begged. "It won't be a bit of bother to you. I have had experience in bringing up cats, and I'm so lonesome for a kitten. Saucy Sal is getting so wild running with the barn cats that I can't associate with her like I used to. And she never was nice to cuddle. Oh, please, please, Aunt Elizabeth." Aunt Elizabeth would not and did not please. She was in a very bad humor that day, anyhow. Nobody knew just why. In such a mood, she was entirely unreasonable. She would not listen to anybody. Laura and Cousin Jimmy had to hold their tongues, and Cousin Jimmy was bidden to take the gray kitten down to the Blair water and drown it. Emily burst into tears over this cruel command, and this aggravated Aunt Elizabeth still further. She was so cross that Cousin Jimmy dared not smuggle the kitten up to the barn as he had first planned to do. "Take that beast down to the pond and throw it in and come back and tell me you've done it," said Elizabeth angrily. "I mean to be obeyed. New Moon is not going to be made a dumping ground for old Jock Kelly's superfluous cats." Cousin Jimmy did as he was told, and Emily would not eat any dinner. After dinner, she stole mournfully away through the old orchard down the pasture to the pond. Just why she went, she could not have told, but she felt that go she must. When she reached the bank of the little creek where Lofty John's brook ran into Blair water, she heard piteous shrieks, and there, marooned on a tiny islet of sere marsh grass in the creek, was an unhappy little beast, its soaking fur plastered against its sides, shivering and trembling in the wind of the sharp autumnal day. The old oatbag in which Cousin Jimmy had imprisoned it was floating out into the pond. Emily did not stop to think or look for a board or count the consequences. She plunged in the creek up to her knees. She waded out to the clump of grass and caught the kitten up. She was so hot with indignation that she did not feel the cold of the water or the chill of the wind as she ran back to New Moon. A suffering or
tortured animal always filled her with such a surge of sympathy that it lifted her clean out of herself. She burst into the cookhouse where Aunt Elizabeth was frying doughnuts.
"Aunt Elizabeth," she cried, "the kitten wasn't drowned after all, and I am going to keep it."
"You're not," said Aunt Elizabeth.
Emily looked her aunt in the face. Again she felt that odd sensation that had come when Aunt Elizabeth brought the scissors to cut her hair.
"Aunt Elizabeth, this poor little kitten is cold and starving, and oh, so miserable. It has been suffering for hours. It shall not be drowned again."
Archibald Murray's look was on her face, and Archibald Murray's tone was in her voice. This happened only when the deeps of her being were being stirred by some peculiarly poignant emotion. Just now, she was in an agony of pity and anger. When Elizabeth Murray saw her father looking at her out of Emily's little white face, she surrendered without a struggle, rage at herself as she might afterwards for her weakness. It was her one vulnerable point. The thing might not have been so uncanny if Emily had resembled the Murrays. But to see the Murray look suddenly superimposed like a mask over alien features was such a shock to her nerves that she could not stand up against it. A ghost from the grave could not have cowed her more speedily. She turned her back on Emily in silence. But Emily knew that she had won her second victory. The gray kitten stayed at New Moon and waxed fat and lovable, and Aunt Elizabeth never took the slightest notice of its existence, save to sweep it out of the house when Emily was not about. But it was weeks before Emily was really forgiven, and she felt uncomfortable enough over it. Aunt Elizabeth could be a not ungenerous conqueror, but she was very disagreeable in defeat. It was really just as well that Emily could not summon the Murray look at will.
Thank you for listening to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, part of the Zoomer Podcast Network. This episode was produced by Duncan Briggs, executive producer Moses Neimer. Discover more of Marilyn's readings, including Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, Vanity Fair, Jane Eyre, and Anne of Green Gables at classicalfm.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also support this series by recommending it to your friends and leaving a 5-star review. Marilyn Lightstone Reads, beautiful stories, beautifully read for a crazy world.